So I wonder where you think Christianity fits in 21st century Britain. Now, I know where most of you think it fits, because I know most of you are Christians. But some would say it has an important place as one of many religious views that contribute to the diversity of our society. Others would say that Christianity has no role in 21st century Britain. It's a relic of the past that's kept us back from truly enjoying and living fulfilled lives. And many Christians therefore feel under threat as they see Christian values and our Christian history as a nation being eroded away by secularism and a quest for diversity. And if you open any Christian magazine or newspaper, there's always a few stories of Christians being sacked, disciplined, or even prosecuted for a stance they've taken over a particular issue. So we write letters to our MPs and we sign petitions, but really in the grand scheme of things, no one really cares. It's a bit of a bleak outlook, and it can be tempting to batten down the hatches and keep ourselves to ourselves and just wait for the second coming. But here in Acts 17, Paul shows a completely different approach. He goes places and he speaks to people and he proclaims Jesus to them. Some people hate him for it, but others join him. And through what he did, millions throughout the generations and through the whole world have come to worship Jesus Christ for themselves. So as we got into chapter 17, Paul is on a journey going around modern day Greece and Turkey, telling people about the good news of Jesus Christ and proclaiming his resurrection from the dead. And at the start of chapter 17, if you look at your Bibles, we see that he's come to Thessalonica. He goes to the synagogue there, and on three consecutive Saturdays, he shows the people from the Old Testament that Jesus was in fact the Jewish Messiah that they were waiting for. But some of the Jewish people weren't keen on what Paul was saying. And so as you do in verse 5 and 6, it says, but the Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace. It sounds fantastically Dickensian. And so all these rapscallions came along and they formed a mob and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. So why didn't they like Paul? Well, it tells us there in verse 6, they tell us what Paul was preaching. So it says, these men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here. So these people were angry because Paul and his band of merry men who were coming and they were preaching about Jesus Christ, and they were saying that there's a new king and a king called Jesus Christ. So Paul and Silas leave the area, and then in verse 10 we read that they go to the next town, which is Berea, and they do exactly the same thing. But the Berean Jews, it says, were of more noble character in verse 11, and then we read in verse 12 then that many of them believed. But unfortunately, our Dickensian Thessalonican thugs hear about this and they get themselves to Berea and they start causing more trouble. So Paul and his men decide to split up. And so we see in verse 14 that the brothers immediately sent Paul to the coast, but Silas and Timothy stayed in Berea. And then it says that the men escorted Paul brought him to Athens and then left with instructions for Silas and Timothy to join him as soon as possible. So Paul is left in Athens without his friends, and he's there to wait for them to come. And so here is Paul. He's in Athens, one of the great cities of the ancient world, one of the great cities of the modern world still, a city famed for being the birthplace of modern democracy, philosophy and science. A city that was the center point for all philosophical, religious and scientific ideas. And so what does Paul do? Well, he takes a look around. That's what he starts doing, but he could have quite easily have kept himself to himself, couldn't he? He could have just looked around and shook his head disapprovingly. But he could have easily then have maybe tried to blend in with all the other philosophers and all the other holy men in the city to try and seek acceptance with all the great and good of Athenian life. But Paul shows a better way, a way that doesn't separate itself from people and their needs, or a way that merges in with what everyone else is doing. And I believe this passage is hugely helpful for us today. We live in a nation that, much like Athens, is a huge melting pot of ideas, philosophies, and religions. Some Christians respond by engaging very well with the world around them, but abandon the centrality of the good news of Jesus Christ and his resurrection. They end up telling people what they want to hear, just with a slight Christian twist on the whole thing. But then, equally worrying, many of us Christians do not engage with the people around us, and rather we look on disapprovingly as Britain leaves Christianity behind. This passage is particularly helpful in two ways. Firstly, it's helpful because we can learn from Paul, and we can learn from how he engaged with people, and how he engaged them specifically with the good news of Jesus Christ. This passage doesn't tell us everything that the Bible says about engaging with our culture, but it gives us a great flavour of how Paul did it. Secondly, this passage is also helpful because it reminds us that the good news of Jesus Christ is powerful in changing people, whole cities, and even whole cultures and civilizations. And this is a message we need to hear, that the gospel of Jesus Christ can change the course of our lives, our family, our friends, our colleagues, our neighborhood, city, and nation. So first of all, let's look in verse 16 that Paul looks around. So that's the first point. Paul looks around. So Paul has been traveling everywhere, and he's been entering these cities and preaching the gospel. But we see from verses 15 and 16 that Paul hadn't intended to go to Athens, certainly not at this point in time. He'd gone there because of the persecution elsewhere. But as Paul is there, he starts looking around the city, and he gets to know it, but something really troubles him. Because we see that Athens was full to the brim with idols. So do you see it there? He was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Now, some estimates that I read put it at 30,000 gods or idols dotted around the place. And one ancient writer said, "It is easier to find a god than a man in Athens." The gods would have covered every aspect of life. There were gods to war, to beauty, to art, and one for each of the professions. So if people wanted something, maybe victory in war, or beauty, or some sort of artistic achievement, or success in a profession, they erected a god for it and worshipped the god in the hope of getting that thing that they were after. What they really worshipped was what those gods promised to give. We worship the same things today: beauty, art, professional success, maybe not victory in war, but certainly a dominance of our nation. But we worship the same things, but what we've done is just cut out the middleman. We don't have those little statues in our homes, but we still worship the same thing. And Paul's really distressed by the whole matter. You see that the word translated there as distressed is elsewhere translated as provoked, stirred, or even exasperated. The word that is there in the Greek gives us our English word paroxysm. It was a word used in the Old Testament of God when he sees the people turn his back on him and turn to other gods. Which shows us that Paul had the heart of God because idolatry provoked him. It stirred him. But as we see later, this provocation, this stirring, fuels him to proclaim the one true God to the people of this great city. I wonder what situations you're in your life. I wonder if, like Paul, the situation that you're in was never part of the plan. But there you are. You're in that place. You're with those people. And I wonder if you like Paul, look at the place where you live or you work or you shop or you socialize, and you see the idols that people worship. Let me give you an example. As some of you know, Emma and I moved house in July, and we now live in Bitton Park, as should all of you. And we live in a block of flats with big electronic gates. So I thought I'd show you my keys. This is all going somewhere, I promise. So here's the electronic gate key so the car can get in. This is the non-electronic gate key to get in. This is to get into the block. And here are the two keys. Oh no, sorry, that's the other gate. And these two keys to get into the flat door itself. I think, why am I talking about keys? Well, what does it tell you about the idols that I have and the people that I live with? Well, we all are people who love security. We don't like people coming into our space. As those of you who visited us will know, it's a nightmare to get in. And for very good reason. We want to keep things secure and safe. We have intercom systems. We even have CCTV cameras. We're all people who want to be safe. We're all people who want to be secure. And a few weeks ago, the gate was stuck open and I was out putting the rubbish out. And some raucous teenagers went past. We have some raucous teenagers with us this evening. And some raucous teenagers went past, made a lot of noise. And because the gate was open, I automatically assumed they were going to come in, beat me up, and steal my wallet. See, I'm someone who idolizes security. And I live with people who also idolize security. Now, I know there's nothing inherently wrong with electronic gates, and if you like me have electronic gates, then not to feel guilty. I'm just saying that as you look at the places where we live, they tell us things about the people that we live with and even the idols of our own heart. And then also then I saw something on the internet related to an idol, and it's a growing new religion with temples everywhere dedicated to it with fanatical followers. And I saw one of its most striking and recent temples on the internet. If Pete could bring it up. There you go. The Apple Store. And I thought, doesn't that just look like a temple? Yeah, I don't think there's any Apple worshippers here. But all these things that we look at, I just thought the box, it looked like the Holy of Holies. Is it just me just making that up? No? Okay, fine. You can take that off now. But all these things, they tell us something about where we live and the sort of things that people idolize, technology, easier way of living. It's all kind of shown to you in that place with the big Apple sign in the middle. So what can you learn as you look around your home, your place of work, where you shop? What does it show to you what people value and desire in life? And how can you learn from these things so you can engage, just like Paul did, with people and speak to them about the good news of Jesus Christ? Now, we don't even look at these things, let alone have our spirits distressed by it like Paul. And maybe it's because we're blinded by our own idolatry of the same things as the people around us. May God open our eyes to see, just like Paul, the idolatry in our own hearts and of those around us. And let's also pray that God would give us hearts that are provoked, distressed and exasperated by the idolatry in our own lives and all around us. But Paul doesn't just leave it at looking around and having his heart broken. He then gets involved with people. Paul deliberately goes where he knows people are gathered, and where people gather to talk about life, the universe and everything. So the second point, Paul talks to people. The first place Paul goes to is the synagogue, where he reasons with the people. And we assume that, like he did in Thessalonica and Berea, he reasons with them from the Old Testament scriptures to show them that Jesus was the true Jewish Messiah. So Paul spends time with these religious people and he speaks to them. And this would have been every Saturday that he would have done that. But the rest of the week he goes to the marketplace or the agora. And so you have it down there in, lost it. So he's in the synagogue, and then as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. So this is where everything would have happened in the life of Athens. So there was obviously the shops there in the marketplace, but there was also law courts, businesses, libraries, concert halls. And it's maybe hard for us to understand what such a place would be like, because we're so connected by technology today. But if you wanted to buy some vegetables, you went to the marketplace. If you wanted to prosecute someone, you went to the marketplace. If you wanted to watch a play, you went to the marketplace. If you wanted to buy some clothes, you went to the marketplace. If you wanted to learn about philosophy or spirituality, you went to the marketplace. And we don't really have an equivalent except for Google, maybe. But Paul goes exactly where all the people are, and he gets stuck in. And then he's accosted by these two groups of philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics. So the Epicureans, they were the materialists, and they downplayed the spiritual and the divine. They didn't necessarily deny God or gods, but insisted that they, if they were there, they were neutral, and they were not involved in the life of people and in the workings of creation. For them, the ultimate good of life was personal comfort and pleasure and the absence of any pain. Their motto was, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Doesn't that sound familiar? The Stoics, on the other hand, saw the divine everywhere. They were pantheists. So they encouraged moderation in everything, and they saw life as something to be endured rather than to be enjoyed. Their motto was something like, grin and bear it. And of course it's from them that we get the word stoical. And in British culture, stoical is seen as something good. Now that sounds very familiar to all of us as well. And it's strange that these two philosophies are still with us today. So with respect, many of you older people are Stoics. So if you're in pain, you don't tell anyone. Your motto is, mustn't grumble. You carry on regardless. Life is about enduring. But many of you younger folk are Epicureans. Pain, hard work, or stress causes you to have a meltdown. You have to tell everyone. It's all over Facebook. Because for us, life is about enjoying ourselves, and we just don't factor pain or hardship into our lives. Is that right? Yeah. And so you see in verse 18 that these Stoics and these Epicureans react to Paul. So it says, a group of Epicurean Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? Others remarked, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. So it's likely that the Epicureans would be saying, what is this babbler saying? In modern terms, they'd say, he's speaking irrational nonsense. He's a stupid man. But it's probably the Stoics that were then saying, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. But Luke very helpfully tells us what the content of Paul's discussions were in verse 18. So it says, they said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. So the Epicureans were reacting one way, the Stoics were reacting another, but Luke tells us that Paul was preaching Jesus and his resurrection. So Paul has spoken to the religious Jews in the synagogue, and he's spoken to the philosophers and also the ordinary people of Athens in the marketplace. But his message has remained consistently the same. He tells all of them about Jesus and his resurrection. And that's what he wanted to talk about. And very happily for Paul, they give him an even greater forum to do that as they invite him to the Areopagus. So our third point is Paul preaches Jesus. So the Areopagus was a council of 12 city elders who acted as a court on all matters relating to the religious, moral, and philosophical life of the city. And it must be said that the reaction in verse 19 and 20 is one of curiosity and not animosity. So they say, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting? You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean. They seem to be genuinely interested in what he had to say, and that is in part because it says in verse 21 that all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. It's interesting, Athens was now no longer the financial and political capital of the world. It's probably because they were all sitting around just talking about things all day rather than doing anything. But Paul stands up and he addresses them. And he starts with his observations of their city. Do you see it there in verse 23?
He says, "For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship is something unknown. I'm going to proclaim to you." Did you notice that he says he looked carefully at their objects of worship? Paul made sure that he learnt about their city and their beliefs in a very careful way. And he tells them that he's found this altar to an unknown God. So like I say, the Athenians had these 30,000 gods in their city, but none of them quite satisfied or fully explained the world around them or their purpose for living. So they set up one more, just in case. And they were desperate to find truth and reality and security, but none of those other gods gave it. So here was one more. And Paul takes this genuine desire for truth and security and reality, and rather than ridiculing it or belittling it or criticizing them, he redirects them to the God who made the world and everything in it, the God who can offer truth and reality and security. And later on, you see in verse 28, if you just drop down with me and have a look, it says, so he's quoting, he says, "For in him we live and move and have our being. And as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." So he quotes twice from Greek poets to support his arguments. Paul has done his homework. He understands the way they think and the things in their culture that and history that they treasure. Why does he do that? Well, we see that Paul uses this idea of the altar to the unknown God as an opportunity to proclaim Jesus Christ to them. But equally, as we go through in the verses that follow, he also understands the obstacles that they will present as he proclaims Jesus Christ to them. So Paul's tone is respectful and it's measured. It's not shrill and belittling. Does that mean that we have to quote Greek poetry in our evangelism? No. But Paul demonstrates how to show love and respect to those that we speak to by understanding their points of view, culture, and history. Not so he can say, "Oh, isn't it all great? We all just believe all the same things anyway. We just use different names and things." No, he doesn't do that. He understands their culture so that he can explain the gospel to them in a way that is clear to their minds. So whilst Paul is respectful and loving in his approach, he's not a coward. So you see that there in the end of verse 23. He very clearly says, "Now what you worship is something unknown. I am going to proclaim to you." Alongside his respectful tone is a boldness and a clarity and even a confrontation. He tells them that they are ignorant, and he tells them that he's going to proclaim about the one true God. Do you remember what I said about the two approaches that Christians seem to take in a hostile culture? One is an approach that merges in and makes Jesus just like one of the other gods. The other is an approach that locks us in and keeps Jesus to ourselves. Paul does neither. He is both loving and honest. He is both respectful and bold. So what does he tell them? Well, first of all, he tells them that God is creator, but he is not creation. Verses 24 to 26, he says, "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them, and the exact places where they should live." Now you remember the Stoics who said that God is everywhere and in everything. Paul tells them that he is not like that at all. He tells them that rather than there being lots of sort of semi-powerful gods who are in charge of different parts of creation, there is one all-powerful God who made everything and therefore rules everything.
Now, this thought would have been very odd to the Greeks who believed in a multitude of gods, all who are in direct competition with each other and causing chaos. Here, however, is one God who reigns over everything and brings order and symmetry. Paul proclaimed a very different God. Secondly, he tells them that God is knowable and not distant. You see it there in verse 27. God did this, that is, created the world and determined the time set for them. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like silver or gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. So you remember that the Epicurean said that even if there was a God, or gods, that they would be distant and they would have nothing to do with us. But Paul proclaims a God who wants to know us, who wants to reach out to us, a God who commands us to repent, that is to turn away from our idols and turn to worship him. The Athenian gods gave the people the stuff that they wanted, but they certainly never offered relationship. Our God offers a relationship. He even offers to be our Heavenly Father. So Paul proclaimed a very different God. And then he tells them that God is judge and not us. In both the Epicurean and Stoic worldviews, the ultimate goal in life was to please our own bodies or to remain in synchrony with creation around us. But Paul points their gaze above this world to a God who cares about how we live our lives and what we worship. This is not an indifferent God who does not care about evil. Here is a God who truly cares and will one day judge the world and make it all right. So Paul proclaimed a very different God. But finally, Paul proclaims Jesus and not an idea. So do you see it there? In verse 31, for he has set a day when he'll judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Paul winds up with the killer punch, the clincher, and he hangs everything that he has just said in the previous verses on Jesus Christ and his resurrection. Now, people would have come in and out of the Areopagus with ideas and thoughts, but Paul proclaims a person, namely Jesus Christ. He hangs all of his arguments on Jesus and his resurrection. Now, up to this point, you could have maybe argued the toss about the other things that Paul had said about God. You could have said, well, I guess that could be true. Maybe I guess it comes down to personal opinion. There are other religions, it would seem, that have similar ideas. But Paul blows all of that out of the water by saying that Jesus was a real person who rose from the dead. He leaves them with a very difficult problem, because by hanging everything he says on Jesus rising from the dead, they either have to accept everything he says or reject everything he says. Because if Jesus rose from the dead, then everything Paul said is true. But if he didn't, then Paul was a total nutcase. Because for the Epicureans and the Stoics, things were true if they were relevant. That is, if they made life more bearable or more pleasurable, they were true. But Paul doesn't proclaim an idea. He proclaims a real person who really rose from the dead. Here's what Tim Keller said when he was preaching on this passage. Christianity is not true because it's relevant. It's relevant because it's true. This is what Paul is saying. You either take it or you leave it. It's either true or it's not. Paul proclaimed a very different God, a creator God, a knowable God, a just God, and a true God who has proven this by raising Jesus from the dead. And that's exactly what happens. Do you see it there in verses 32 to 34? There were in fact three reactions.
that we have here. So when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. Others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. So those two sets of people didn't believe. At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Some said, what a load of rubbish. Some were intrigued and said, maybe I'll think about it. And others said, yes, I believe too. So who were these people? Well, one of them was an elder on the council. Another was a woman with no title or role. And then there were some other people who remain nameless. People may sneer. Some people may be indifferent. But we must expect God to work when Jesus and his resurrection are proclaimed. We must expect that God will open people's eyes to see it. See, we have an amazing God who raised Jesus Christ from the dead and who in the same power will also bring people to faith as we proclaim Jesus and his resurrection. So what about you and what about me? We aren't like Paul. But each of us finds ourselves in a particular place and in a particular time and surrounded by particular people. We may not be in Athens or a leading city of our day. We may be just in our office or with our course mates, at home or anywhere that we find ourselves. But Jesus Christ is risen from the dead, and that means that everything God says about himself, that he is a creator, that he wants to be in relationship with us, and that he is a just judge is true. And it means that anything is possible, and it means that we have a good news to proclaim to a world who need to know their God.